This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Success of a species is based on two things, procreating and staying alive. Or as Mara Hart puts it in her new book, Sex in the Sea, getting busy and not getting eaten. Although she uses an even racier term for the former. Hart brings us on a bold ride through the red light district of the deep blue sea, where polyamorous right whales, libidinous lobsters, swinging groupers, and other creatures conduct elaborate mating rituals in the place where life began, the ocean. While it may sound smutty, it is science, and Hart makes the case that humans play a critical role in sustaining a sex-positive environment in the world's oceans. Mara Hart is a coral reef ecologist and research co-director for Future of Fish. And Mara, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
So voyeurism aside, why should we be interested in what sex looks like in the sea?
It's a fair question, and really the answer is pretty simple. Sex and successful sex, leading to reproduction, is the heart of sustainability. So sex is what drives all the abundance that feeds the fish that feed us. It's what allows for the prolific procreation of oysters that build giant reefs that provide food and shoreline protection. It's what allows corals to build their own giant reefs that provide medicine and habitat for countless species, including us. Without that kind of sex, we don't have diversity and we don't have the amazing bounty that we all rely on.
Well, let's talk about some of these tiny building blocks. And it starts with locating a mate. And in the case of copepods, these little creatures that can be tiny as sesame seeds, how do they find each other in this vast, vast sea?
Yeah, not only are they tiny, but some of them only live a few weeks to a few months. So the clock is ticking for them to be able to find one another. And researcher Jeanette Yen explained it to me this way. She's out of Georgia Tech University and noted that they go to singles bars in the ocean. And these are areas where there are boundary layers. So if you think of the ocean as more like a layer cake, there's warm layers and cold layers, saltier layers and fresher layers. And all of these different parts of the ocean stack up, and where they meet is a boundary layer. And in that layer, copepods are sensitive enough to be able to detect the calm space in between these two portions of ocean. And in that calm space, they're able to swim around and concentrate their numbers. So that's the first thing that they can do, is by meeting in these thin areas, they're reducing the total area that they have to look for one another. But because copepods are really, really small, water feels very different for them. It's more like what it would feel like for us if we swam through a giant pool of molasses. It's really thick. And so as a copepod swims, it's actually pushing the water out in front of it and leaving a long trail behind. And males can detect these trails of the females. And the female sometimes will even help the male out by sort of squirting some pheromones into that trail and creating a scented corridor. And as soon as the male hits one of these trails, he can hone in and zoom up the trail to find the female.
These are calm varieties of singles bars.
Right. Very zen singles bars.
Well, blue whales, they have a little more to work with. They emit deep, deep, berry white deep, as you put it, baritone sounds. How does that help them find mates?
So sound travels really far and really well in the ocean, far better than it does through the air. So all whales, not just blue whales, but many species of whales, the males will use sound to navigate, to find and communicate with other individuals in their pods or across ocean regions. We now know that whales off of New England can be literally communicating with a whale in Bermuda. So they can cover vast distances. And what researchers have found with blue whales has been really interesting. Across the world, over the last 30 to 40 years, they've been lowering and lowering the songs, the pitch of their songs. So again, yeah, they're going deep like Barry White does. And this was strange because we were trying to figure out, you know, why why would there be this, you know, universal drop, right? Nobody's coordinating this kind of effect. What could be going on? And what happened with blue whales was back in the 20th century, they were severely overhunted. The populations in Antarctica, for example, were decimated by over 95%. So if you were a blue whale trying to find a mate, your odds were pretty low. They were scattered far and wide. So at that point in time, blue whales were singing at a frequency that would allow their songs to travel as far and loud as possible, right? Their main concern was just finding a mate. But over recent years, in a wonderful story of recovery, since the moratorium on whaling has gone into effect, the blue whale numbers are going up. And while we don't know that this is exactly the cause, that this is our best guess right now, is that as these numbers have gone up, the males aren't as concerned with finding a mate as they are with seducing that mate. Hmm. And we know that across the animal kingdom, females dig a deeper voice.
So once they find each other, of course, there is the consummation. Deep voice is one seductive thing. Lobsters, not particularly romantic. Sex for them means, I think as you put it, peeing in your lover's face. What?
But they can be romantic. So they're sort of this cool combination of kinky and tender. And it's not what you would think of looking at them. But with lobsters, what happens is the male is very aggressive during mating season. He's a big brute. And he uses his pee to intimidate other males. And he'll go around and spray his urine into the dens of neighboring males and sort of work his way in there to show just who's boss. And all of that urine sort of swishing around in the ocean starts to attract females. And the females are attracted to the most dominant male. And this is because females want to know that they are going to be protected during and after mating. So the best time for lobsters to mate is right after a female molts. This is when she loses her shell. And as part of the shell on the underside of her tail, there's a sperm receptacle. This is where the male places the sperm. And when she molts, any leftover sperm will go out the door along with that old shell, and a new receptacle will form. So for the female, mating right after a molt means she can fill up her stores of sperm and be able to fertilize multiple batches of eggs before she has to molt again. For the male, it means he doesn't have to worry that there's already sort of a half-full receptacle there. He can fill the entire thing all with his own sperm. What this means, though, is that when a female molts, she's a soft-bodied animal. That shell is normally her armor and her strength. And right after molting, she can't even stand up. She's just like a big jelly blob. And so she's extremely vulnerable. And again, these males are extremely aggressive. So it's a very dangerous situation for her. So what she does is she uses her pee as a magic love potion. And by spraying a male in the face for a few days in a row, the female will approach his den, give a little squirt, and then kind of beat it out of there before he has a chance to retaliate. This urine tends to have a seductive effect. It's an aphrodisiac. And the male becomes calmer and starts to show signs that he's actually interested in mating. He will invite that female in. And then he sort of stays in this entranced, very lover-friendly state for up to a week, waiting for the female to molt. And they pee each other this whole time. They'll stroke each other with the antenna. They'll also touch each other with their feet. And lobsters' taste buds are on their feet. So they're actually like licking each other with their feet. Then the female will molt. And she gives the male this really cool sign that Professor Yael Etema, who's at Boston University, he nicknamed this knighting, because the female will circle in front of the male, pee in his face, and then the male will sort of put his big claws down in the sand. He'll bow his head down, and then she'll lift one of her big claws and tap him on one shoulder and then the other shoulder, just like you would see in a knighting ceremony. And it's this signal that she's saying, all right, don't leave me now, baby. It's about to happen. Let's get it on. And then the male will go over and very gently, very delicately, he will actually lift her up and cradle her in his arms, because again, she can't stand on her own. And he holds her on her back so that they're belly to belly, and the mating process then proceeds.
The love lives of lobsters, one of the things we're learning about from Mara Hart. She's author of Sex in the Sea, which covers the sometimes kinky, sometimes salty, intimate lives of the creatures of the deep and our intimate connection with them. Well, Mara, we're talking about, you know, singles bars, knighting, Barry White. I'm sure listeners notice that we are anthropomorphizing. You know, we're attributing human yes. characteristics to animals or vice versa, which is the essential premise in this book. This is something that some scientists frown upon. Have you gotten any pushback on this?
I expect to. Yeah. You know, it was a conscious choice. And the idea for this book came out of a deep desire to break out from the usual norm of how we talk about conservation and ocean management and really try to get the attention and stir up the curiosity of folks who don't normally think about oceans and aren't aware of some of the issues they face. The best way that I could think of to help folks feel a connection was to try to draw these analogies and paint the picture in as human terms and as relatable terms as possible. And there is a little warning at the beginning that, you know, everything in here is meant to be taken with a grain of salt, so to speak. It is based on absolute science. But yes, the phrases and terminologies and some of the assumed personalities that are going into these animals are, of course, out of my own imagination to try to get folks to think a little bit differently about these creatures and be able to relate to what seems like such a foreign and alien space.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the critical nature of what's going on with the oceans. You spoke to a number of researchers who study reproductive habits of marine species and note changes over the last century. And we know, you know, there's a lot more human-generated waste in the ocean than there was a century ago. Also, climate change is affecting life in the oceans. But you spend a lot of time talking about overfishing. Tell us about how that impacts the reproductive lives of ocean creatures.
Sure. So overfishing affects species in a number of different ways. We know for decades now that we have been taking out more fish than the oceans are able to replace. And part of that is because of the reproductive habits. So one example I like to point out is in many fish populations, an individual fish changes sex over the course of its lifetime. For example, in some grouper species, they'll start as females and mate as a female when they're small. And then when they're big enough to take over and sort of dominate a harem, they'll change to be male. And there's a lot of reproductive benefit that can come from that. But you can also imagine that fishers tend to like the biggest fish. That tends to be what we go for. So in these species, when we are fishing, if we are fishing out all the biggest individuals, not only are we reducing the number of individuals in the population, but we are also skewing the sex ratio. So we might be leaving enough folks in the sea. We might be leaving enough of those groupers. But if they're all female, that creates a big problem.
Well, I'd like to dig into overfishing a little bit because you make the point, of course, both biology and behavior play into how much pressure a species can take before it can't replace numbers from its populations. So if we are trying to create a sea environment where the sex lives of creatures are not stressed out, are there more sex-friendly choices we can make in seafood?
Absolutely. And I love the phrase of sex-friendly seafood. That's what we should all be all be going for. And so there are. So some species have very fast reproductive cycles. And these tend to be species that live lower down on the food web. So sardines and mackerels and anchovies. Also, shellfish like oysters and mussels and clams are incredibly prolific and can withstand a fair amount of harvest if we manage them well. So those are all great options. What we want to also try to do is alleviate the pressure that we put on really the top species that we tend to always go to, salmon, shrimp, tuna. We tend to be very boring eaters, at least in North America, and getting a little bit more adventurous is a good idea in the sense that it just disperses some of that pressure. There are wonderful species that fishers are catching all the time that are sort of lumped into this quote-unquote bycatch, meaning it's accidental that they're being caught. But many of them are perfectly healthy, wonderful protein sources. Redfish and pollock in the Atlantic are some examples. And they would make for fantastic protein and, again, give fishers an income, but take some of the pressure off of those species that are constantly being, you know, hammered all the time. So being a little bit more adventurous and eating lower on the food chain are great ways to help promote more sex-friendly seafood.
Mara Hart, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mara Hart, she's an ecologist and research co-director for Future of Fish. For more on her new book, Sex in the Sea, go to wordofmouthradio.org.